Thanks to the Breakfast team for another great Brekkie show. Next up is Discovery, your weekly dose of science news and views.
Welcome. 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 Welcome.
Stand and welcome.
Hello, good evening and welcome
to Discovery.
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 Welcome to Discovery.
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 Sounds like a lot of fun.
Somewhere in space, this may all be happening right now.
Now to the speeded up brain of a user, that sound lasts for 4 hours and sounds like this.
Discovery. Yeah.
Hello and welcome to Discovery, the National Science Radio Show. I'm David Huang. On this edition, we'll look at saving money and fuel with hybrid cars that run on both electricity and petrol, and geology tours in Tasmania. But first up, here's the news. A radar in the Antarctic that will bounce radio waves off meteors is one of the latest tools to study climate change. The radar will provide information on the mesosphere, a layer of the atmosphere about 100 kilometres above the Earth's surface that until now hasn't been extensively studied. The mesosphere is believed to be extremely sensitive to climate change. While measurements suggest that the lower atmosphere has been warming in recent years, it is thought that the mesosphere may be cooling even faster, at a rate of up to 1 degree centigrade per year. The mesosphere is difficult to study. Aircraft and weather balloons can't reach it because of the low air pressure, and satellites burn up when they enter the mesosphere. The new radar, which is a joint project between the University of Bath in the UK and the British Antarctic Survey, will use a different strategy to study the mesosphere. By bouncing radio waves off meteors entering the atmosphere, it will be possible to measure the speeds of the meteors and thereby determine the wind speed in the mesosphere. The temperature can also be determined by measuring the fading of the radio echoes from the meteors. With thousands of meteors hitting the atmosphere every day, the researchers believe that the radar will give almost continuous measurements of the mesosphere. Losing weight could be the key to financial success, according to a new study. Scientists at Ohio State University in the US found that weight loss was linked to increases in wealth among white men and women and among black women. But weight loss had little effect on wealth for black men. Weight gain was also found to be associated with decreases in wealth, with the strongest correlation found for white women. The study used financial and height and weight data for over 7,000 people who were involved in a long-term survey between 1985 and 2000. The people were compared according to a standard measure of obesity called the Body Mass Index, or BMI. A person's BMI is simply their weight in kilograms divided by the square of their height in meters. The researchers found that a 10-point decrease in BMI resulted in an average wealth gain of almost $12,000 for white women, almost $13,000 for white men, and about $4,500 for black women. But the study doesn't suggest that weight loss is a good get-rich-quick scheme, since large decreases in weight of over 10 kilos were required to make substantial gains in wealth of several thousand dollars. Although the study found a strong link between weight loss and wealth gain, it wasn't possible to tell definitively whether weight loss was responsible for wealth gain or if there was any causal relationship at all. But the study did prove that wealth gain is not the cause of weight loss, since people who suddenly became wealthy as a result of an inheritance didn't lose weight as a result. The koala could help in the fight against the most common sexually transmitted disease in humans, chlamydia, according to researchers at the Queensland University of Technology. Chlamydia is a major cause of infertility in women, and cases of the disease are increasing at a rate of 20% per year. The researchers say that studying chlamydia in koalas will lead to a better understanding of the disease in humans. They say they are close to developing a chlamydia vaccine for koalas and hope to have a human vaccine ready for trials in several years. Running vehicles on fuels obtained from plants, like ethanol and biodiesel, has been viewed as an environmentally friendly alternative to fossil fuels. But according to researchers in the United States, more energy is used to produce these fuels than is generated by them when they're used to drive vehicles. The researchers at Cornell University and the University of California at Berkeley looked at the energy required to produce a number of plant fuels, such as ethanol from corn and biodiesel from soybean and sunflower plants. They accounted for the energy used in producing pesticides and fertilizer for the crops, running farm machinery, irrigating, grinding and transporting the crops, and fermenting and distilling the ethanol. They found that corn used 29% more fossil fuel energy than the ethanol fuel produced, and that sunflower plants required a whopping 118% more fossil fuel energy than the biodiesel produced. The researchers say that biofuels are not the answer to our energy problems, and that other alternatives to fossil fuels, such as solar energy or hydrogen, should be used instead. With the price of crude oil reaching record levels recently, Australian drivers are being warned that petrol could soon cost more than $1.20 per litre. This has led to renewed interest in more fuel-efficient vehicles, such as hybrid cars that run on both petrol and electricity. Dr. Howard Lovett has been involved in designing hybrid vehicles at the CSIRO's Division of Industrial Physics. He spoke to me about the technology behind these vehicles.
The most common type of hybrid vehicle, if we're talking about a car, would be what is termed a parallel hybrid. This is where the conventional petrol engine or diesel engine drives the wheels directly, but is assisted by an electric motor that can, in parallel, also drive the wheels. For larger vehicles like trains or ships, they use an arrangement called a series hybrid, where the engine drives a generator and then the main drive is entirely electric. There's no mechanical coupling between the engine and the drive.
So what sorts of fuel savings are we talking about for a hybrid vehicle compared with a conventional car?
It really depends on how much electrical boost you give. And there's two generally accepted terms of mild hybrids, which don't run under purely electric mode at all. If the vehicle's moving, the engine will be started with a mild hybrid. It just assists the engine. They give, you know, the 10 to 20% fuel saving level. Then there are what are termed full hybrids, which have the ability to run at low speeds and short distances in electric-only mode. And they typically give maybe up to 50% fuel saving.
And how does a hybrid vehicle improve on, or how is it better than an all-electric vehicle or a vehicle that runs on other sources of energy like biofuel or solar energy?
It's better than an electric vehicle because the range of electric vehicles is limited by batteries, which currently don't have the energy storage density of a liquid fuel like petrol. So the batteries are physically large and they're heavy, and this encumbers the vehicle. Compared with a solar vehicle, they are better because the cost of solar cells is prohibitively high for a normal vehicle, although obviously the solar car racing has been very successful in demonstrating what may be possible in the future. And in terms of biofuels, there's still an advantage with using hybrids that run on any type of fuel, whether it's a bio or a fossil fuel, in that it consumes less fuel. You should remember that a biofuel still has to be grown. And even if it's not a net contributor to, say, CO2, it will still contribute to other problems like usage of water to grow the biofuel and urban pollution, because when it's burnt, it will still release compounds of nitrogen, nitrous oxides, and NOxes, and same with sulfur, SOxes, which are the main constituents of urban pollution. So a hybrid is a good technology for today.
So currently the market share for hybrid vehicles is quite small in Australia. I believe there's only a couple passenger vehicles available. Do you expect this to change in the near future?
It's certainly changed in other countries. In Japan and the States, there's quite a selection of vehicles. In Australia, there's the Honda Civic Hybrid and the Toyota Prius. The Toyota Prius has actually sold very well in Australia, and around the globe, though, it is quite a big seller. They sell about, I think the latest figures were they were selling 125,000 vehicles a year, and they also sell quite a selection, both Honda and Toyota, quite a selection of other vehicles in other countries, but unfortunately only one from each manufacturer at the moment in Australia.
It's not really technological limitations that are limiting the number of vehicles that are currently on the road. Is it the cost of the vehicles that are preventing more people from owning them?
Yes, I think you're right there. That's currently the incremental cost of adding a hybrid system to a vehicle is too high. So most of the research is actually centred not on improving performance, which is considered good enough at the moment, but on reducing cost. Most vehicle manufacturers are currently very much in favour of hybrids, and we will increasingly see them introduced around the world and hopefully more vehicles available for sale in Australia.
Dr. Howard Lovett from CSIRO Industrial Physics. You're listening to Community Radio's National Science Show, Discovery, brought to you across Australia by the Community Radio Network. Still to come, geology tours in Tasmania.
When they kick at your front door, how are you gonna come with your hands on your head? Or on the trigger of your gun. When the law break in, how you gonna go? Shot down on the pavement, or waiting on death row. You can crush us, you can bruise us, but you have to answer too. It well, but surely your time will come, as in heaven, as in hell. You see, he feels like Ivan, born under the Brixton sun. His game is called surviving. At the end of the harder they come, you know, it means no mercy. See, they caught him with a gun. No need for the Black Maria. Goodbye to the Brixton sun. You can crush us, you can bruise us, yeah, even shoot us. But oh, the guns of Brixton. When they kick at your and bruises, yeah, even shoot us, but oh, the guns of Brixton, shot down on the pavement, waiting in death row. This game's called surviving, as in heaven, as in hell. You can bruise us, but you'll have to answer to. Oh,
That was Nouvelle Vague with the Guns of Brixton.
Hi, this is Alan Wilton. I'm a lecturer in genetics at the University of New South Wales. I always spend my time in the lab working on DNA from dingoes and domestic dogs, and we're looking at how domestic dogs are driving the dingoes into extinction. And if you want to find out more about this and other science, then listen to Discovery on 2SER.
And now our Tasmanian correspondent, Taylor Bildstein, takes a tour of the geology of the Apple Isle.
My name's Keith Corbett. I'm a consultant geologist these days, running a small consultancy working mainly for several mining and mineral exploration companies and also for the state government. As a sideline, I also run tours to places like the west coast of Tasmania with geology as one of the major interests.
Can you describe your business that involves taking tours on the west coast of Tasmania?
Yes, that was something that came out of some trips I did early on with groups of geologists and geophysicists. It struck me then that there was so much to see of interest to just about everybody in places like the West Coast. And I thought, well, goodness, why is nobody bringing ordinary people over here to show them all these wonderful things? And one of the drivers that was on one of the tours said, you know, I run a tour business. Why don't we get together sometime and look at taking tours to the West Coast? Think about it. And I thought about it, and 2 years later, we did it.
So you didn't start from scratch. You combined your expertise in Tasmanian geology with your partner, the tourism operator's expertise in operating tourism.
It was a pretty fortunate combination. He knew what was involved in organising tours. He was also an old prospector.
And what kind of service do you offer for people who joined those tours?
They're not totally science-oriented. They're generally fairly general interest. We look at geology and botany, of course, but also the mining history, the cultural history. We look at the people involved in prospectors and the pioneers who found the mineral deposits and developed them, and we look at the stories associated with those early days, some of the great fights and feuds and arguments, and some of the wonderful things that were achieved in the days when most of the West Coast was still a wilderness.
What fascinates you the most about Tasmanian geology?
This is one of the great places in the world for geology, undoubtedly. Tasmania is a small place, but it's a pocket dynamo when it comes to geological features. We have here in this quite small area representative rocks from every major geological period in the Earth's history.
Would you say that geology affects Tasmania's economy?
Geology has an enormous influence on our economy. For example, tertiary basalts, mostly on the northwest coast, but also through the northeast in places. Those rich red basalt soils are the cornerstone of our agricultural economy. Most of our dairying industry, our crops, potato crops, all those other things are there because of those wonderfully fertile soils. Another example, the Jurassic dolerite, all those great dolerite peaks and mountains throughout the state. Fantastic scenery, critical to our tourist industry, critical to our concrete industries, our road aggregate industries. Nearly all of Tasmania's roads are made of crushed dolerite. But as well as that, there's the hydroelectric potential. Because we've got high country, lots of rainfall, big rivers, we are able to develop our hydroelectric power. One other example, the old pre-Cambrian quartzites, totally barren, totally useless for agriculture, out there in the southwest. And because they're totally useless for agriculture, nobody's ever bothered to put a road in. And as a result, we now have an enormous area of virtually untouched wilderness. And all of our southwest wilderness is there because of the barrenness of those old quartzites.
Dr. Keith Corbett, thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.
Taylor Bildstein speaking with consultant geologist Dr. Keith Corbett. You're listening to Discovery. That was El Oso with Tonight's Now Tomorrow.
60 Second Science.
Ever wanted to know how to keep cool without harming the environment? A new device from CSIRO allows us to do this. All conventional air conditioners release chemicals that attack the ozone layer and contribute to the greenhouse effect. This new package from the energy technology team means we no longer have to worry about greenhouse gas emissions or electricity demand when keeping ourselves cool. While solving the problems of emissions and peak electricity demand, the new package, named Trigenair, is also economically attractive. It achieves this by doubling the efficiency by which fuel is used for energy, which in turn halves greenhouse emissions. The Trigenair package is ideally suited for small to medium enterprises, such as hospitals, supermarkets, and small businesses, but is also a feasible device for the family home in the coming years. It is currently in use at the Hornsby Council Library as a test run, and if found to be a success, it will then be available for commercial purchases. So next time you need a new air conditioner, think of Trigenair and how you can do your part to help the environment.
60 Second Science.
Angus Donald from Knox Grammar School. 60 Second Science is brought to you by high school students enrolled in the University of Sydney's course Problem Solving and Communication in Science.
O'Neill. Lyon.
And that's all from us in this edition of Discovery. If you would like to contact us, you can reach us via email at discovery@2ser.com. That's discovery@2ser.com. This week's show was brought to you by Taylor Bildstein and me, David Huang. Discovery has been produced in the studios of 2SER in Sydney and is broadcast nationally via the Community Radio Network. Join us for more science next week on Discovery.